All right, so here on slide 6.4, it discusses the leakless node declaration issues. If we define, for example, here, we've got our item defined, whatever item or class, whatever we're going to put in the list. If we type define a structure to be node, inside of that node, we need to have, of course, our item storage, which we'll define as element. But we also need a pointer to another node. And we can call that next. The problem is that code for that first box up there will not compile because we can't use the name of the structure that we're defining inside of it before it's defined. We can, if we don't use the type def with the structure, we can then just use the struct alone here in the next box to name the structure, and then we can use the name inside of the structure declaration to define a pointer to it. That code will define, but it's usually considered a little bit better practice to type define the pointer type to make it clear that you are going to be having the defining essentially a recursive type of structure where you're going to be defining a structure such that inside of the structure will be a link to that same structure, to a structure of the same type. That's in a sense sort of a self-referencing declaration, as it's sometimes called. And so we get into a little bit of the chicken and the egg problem. If we wanted to do that, if we wanted to say type def node star node pointer, so that we could use that node pointer type defined inside of our structure declaration, we would first have to have node previously defined. And how can we have it previously defined in order to define a type that we want to use in the definition? Well, the language solution for that is to basically do a forward declaration. And this also works with classes, too. You say struct, and then the name, and semicolon. That's basically just a flag to the compiler to tell it that enter this structure type in your type list so that I can refer to it, and I'll define it a little bit later on. That then allows us to define a type to that structure type, and then define it later on, and use the pointer type inside of it. Okay? I can then also define like head to be of node pointer type, like in main or some function here. My batteries are dying. I can define head and set it equal to null. That essentially means the list is empty. The null pointer is used to both indicate an empty list, and it's also used to indicate the end of the list. When you get to a node where the next pointer in a node is null, then there's no more nodes past that one, so you're at the last node of the list, which is the end of the list. Now, here on 6.5, here's some code that forms a few lists. So we've got a couple node pointers here defined, and initialized to null. We set p equal to new node. The new function goes out, allocates a new structure of type node, and returns a pointer to it. And that's just set to p. And then we can use the arrow operator to that structure to access the elements of that structure, the members of that structure. So we can set element equal to 120, piece of arrow next to null, head to p, p to null. And over here on the right is the result of each of those assignment statements sort of diagrammed up graphically. The first time when we, after line one, when we say p equals new node, that sets p to point to a node with undefined content. And then we basically just define each of those contents, and then we set head to point to the first one. Down here, then, if we want to add another element in front of that one, we go get us another new node. We set its element to some value, like 28. We set the next, its next field to point to head. That would set it to point to the same node that head's pointing to. And then we would set head to point to P, so that we retarget head to be this one, so that it's now the first node in the list. Even though we allocated it second, it's probably later in memory. Logically, it's first in the list. And if we keep doing this, we can get another node, set it equal to 6, do the same thing, set it next to head, set head to P, and we just keep adding elements like that. Now, you can form lists like this, but in reality, this isn't really the way linked lists are formed or accessed. It's similar to it, but this is done in functions that do this basically one node at a time. What would the following statement here do? If I said delete P, what would that do? It would deallocate what? The node containing 6. P then would be undefined. What about head? Head would be a dangling pointer, because head would now be referring to that node that was previously deallocated. And what about what about those other nodes? They are now a memory leak. Okay? They're now a memory leak. I was planning on using it and I didn't. Now, here on the next slide, we talk about how to do a list traversal. Once you have a list existing in memory, at times you will need to perform a walk on the list or traverse the list so that you basically visit each node one right after the other and maybe do things with the nodes. Who knows? We can do this by basically defining another pointer, setting it equal to head. That would set Q to head after statement 1. We could then set Q equal to Q arrow next. That sets it actually to point to the second node, which is 28. Q arrow next. Q is first pointing to head, so Q arrow next is this pointer. So when I set Q equal to that pointer, it sets it to point to the same place, which is the second node. I could then at that point set Q equal to Q or head, arrow next, arrow next. Head, arrow next, arrow next. That's this pointer. That would set it to point to the third node. Now, that's really inefficient because it takes too many dereferences. Since Q's already pointing at the second node anyway, I can once again just re-execute the same statement I did in statement 2, and that has the same result. So, using that logic, you can really just write a simple loop to traverse a linked list. You can set a temporary pointer equal to the head. While that pointer is not equal to null, then in the while loop, at that point you're at the first node. So you can do something with the node that you're currently at. Once you're finished doing something with that node, then you can advance to the next node by just setting the pointer equal to itself arrow next. And you just keep doing that until you eventually set it to the null pointer in the last node, and that stops the while loop. Myself, as a personal coding preference, I tend to code these statements of Q not equal to null, I tend to code them while Q. Why does that work? Huh? It evaluates the true when Q is not null. Because null is 0, and any non-zero value is true. Okay? Code it however you wish. code it however you wish. I don't care. I would argue that this coding as just while Q will allow most compilers to produce just slightly more efficient code. Just slightly, okay? Not going to be much faster, just a little bit. Now you do have to, you better understand how this list traversal works, because you're going to be doing that a lot. And it's probably the most common sort of thing that you do on linked lists. Anybody have any questions about doing a list traversal? And you're actually going to have to sort of figure out how to do it a little bit from different perspectives. Now, here on slide 6.7, we have some sorted and ordered list operations. In order to allow someone who's using our linked list to be able to manipulate it in just about any way that they would need to, we should provide an interface to our linked list. A set of operations that will basically do whatever they need to do to the linked list to manipulate it. We can define a set for an ordered list, a list where there is some ordering defined upon the element, and when you put another element in the list, another item in the list, it'll maintain that ordering. So, being cold. So here we've got these set of operations. Make list to sort of initialize the list to be empty. Empty list, just test whether it is empty. Full list, test whether it's full. Insert, takes an item and inserts it in the list in the ordered position. Remove, searches the list for an item with some key value and deletes it. Retrieve element, searches the list for an item with some key value and returns the element. Modify, searches the list for an item with some key value and replaces it with the given item. And destroy list, just erases all the elements in the list. So these ordered lists, abstract data type operations, basically maintain the ordering and the integrity of the list structure. Not the user or the client code. This way, if there's a problem with the list, as I stated earlier, we know where the code is that manipulates the list, so we know where the problem is at. We don't have to go looking at the entire system of code to figure out where the problem is at. An unordered list, abstract data type, it embodies sort of the concept of a current list position and basically has a different set of operations to allow a user to do something with that to advance that list position and reset it. The ordered lists, they don't need to do that, because they're the ones who's doing determining where something goes or where something gets removed from. So they don't have to let the user be bothered with worrying about any positions in the list. They keep track of all of that themselves. So here on slide 8, here is a type definition for a linked list. And you can see we've done this trick again with the type defined, where we'll use an arbitrary capsule type like item, and in our node we'll define that field to be of that data field to be of that arbitrary type. That way, if we want to pick up this code and use it for a different application, all we would have to do is redefine that type definition to whatever we wanted to store it in. Right now, you should be able to do that with your array. Not that I would, be mean enough to make you do that. Think about it. What if in the last program I told you, or what if I actually had you write, instead of the fourth program we're going to write in here, maybe I decided we'd write five Hypothetically speaking, okay? And what if I said, well, now, we'll make the fifth program your linked list program, and for the fourth program, all I want you to do is take your program that you're working on now and rip out your computer system class and put in another different class in your array. Now, if you've done it correctly, this shouldn't be a problem. Because all you would have to do would be code up the other class, go into some header file, and redefine the item type to whatever your new class is, that you establish a type equivalency in there, and the array operations shouldn't care whatsoever that they're now storing objects of a different class. And we can do the same thing here with our linked list. Now we want to as much as possible limit the dependency and really try to make it completely independent. We want to limit the dependency of the linked list code on the particular item that is being stored in there. Now we can do that quite easily by using the standard language operators, both for comparison, assignment, whatever, and then we can just overload those for some different class. And as long as the linked list class only uses those standard operators, we could also use it to store not only classes, but we could also use it to store simple types like integers or doubles, whatever, where those operators are also defined for those simple data types. Now, if we're not using a class, if we were not using a class where we could not overload the relational operators and other operators that the linked list class uses, then we would have a bit of a problem. If we were doing a non-object-oriented implementation, we would still want to limit the dependency as much as possible. Rather than storing a class object in the linked list, what if we actually needed to store structures? Okay, well, the way we could do that, one way we could do that and minimize the effect on the list code would be to sort of define some relational comparison operators like less than, equal to, greater than, and require that whatever client code uses our linked list, that they implement these functions. That way, we don't have to implement them in our linked list so that we make our linked list dependent upon what's being stored in there. It is slightly dependent because now it does require these operators to be defined, these functions less than, equal to, greater than, and that does require a modest amount of dependency, but not as much as if we were actually accessing the individual elements of some structure. A minor point nowadays, this sort of point is put by the wayside with the use of classes and operator overloaders. So, here's some of those basic operations implemented here on slide 6.9. To make lists, all we would need to do is set the head equal to null. That would make the list empty. Now you have to be careful. What if make list would be executed upon an existing list? That would be very bad. Why? It would delete the list?
Make the head null, delete the list. Yeah.
It would make the head null, but it would leave the list there, which means we would have a big memory leak, possibly. Right. So we would have to be very careful. Now, we don't have to worry about this with classes because this will basically become our constructor. You have a question? Okay. To test to see whether it's empty, we just check to see if head's null. To check to see whether it's full, that gets a little dependent upon the underlying implementation. You can actually implement linked lists with pointers and dynamic memory, And you can implement them other ways. We'll talk about some of those other ways later. We won't worry about that at the moment. To destroy the list, we need to basically deallocate every node that's in the list. The way we will do that is we will use some temporary pointer, and we'll set that equal to head. And then while head's not equal to null, we'll move head to the next one. And then we'll delete that node by deleting P that head was referring to. And then we'll reset P to the new head, which is the second one. And we'll keep doing that. So we'll use two pointers, head and another one, and we'll basically walk through the list a pair of nodes at a time, always deleting the trailing node. That's the way you safely deallocate an entire list. I can't say just delete head. All that would do is get rid of the first node, and the rest of the nodes would still be leaked around in memory with me having no way to access them. Now, here's list insertion. Here's the details of doing an ordered insertion. To start off with, if we insert it, to insert into an empty list, all we have to do is we get a new node, we initialize the element, we initialize its next to null, and we set head to that one. That's the way, that's the simple. That's all you do to create a one element list from an empty list. To insert at the tail of the list, you first have to have a pointer to the last node in the list. Now how you get that pointer is, once again, it depends upon, for example, if we, you will probably have to, you will have to do a list traversal. We might have, here we might look and say, well, okay, we want to add 120 to this list. So we do some list traversal. And as long as the element stored in the node is greater than the one that we're trying to insert, we keep moving until we get to the end of the list. We stop when we're at the last node in the list, and we check to see maybe if this element that we're wanting to insert goes after this one. And since it does, then what we do is we get a new node. We once again, we just put the element in there that we want to add. We set its next to null. And now we set the pointer of the last node to be equal to this new pointer. So we have to use our temporary pointer and set its next to be equal to P. That basically attaches this new node onto the end of the list. Okay? That's the way you do an insertion at the end of a list. There's basically four cases of doing insertion. Inserting at the head, or inserting into an empty list, inserting at the tail of the list, inserting into the middle of the list is the next case. And the last case is inserting at the, in, before the front of the list. Now, to insert into the middle of the list, this gets a little tricky, because if we were doing a little follow to traverse the list, saying as long as the element that we're wanting to add is greater than the element that we're currently pointing at, move to the next node. If we said that, we would actually stop when we were here at the node containing 71. But the disadvantage of that is that we want to actually insert this new node just less than that one. We want to insert it in front of it. So we need to change the pointer of the previous node, which we've now bypassed. There are a couple solutions for that, which we will cover a little bit later on. At the moment, let's just assume that we know that we're smart enough to stop at the preceding node. So, to insert after some node that we're pointing at in the list, we still do the same thing. We get a new node, we put our element there, or we'll just go ahead and set its next to null just to, for consistency. But then we would need to set its next of this node, of this new node, we would set its next equal to temp arrow next. That would set it to point to the next node that we're currently pointing at. And then we retarget the next of the current node to point to P. So So now we basically, if you follow the pointers, we've logically inserted this new node in between those two without having to do any shifting of memory around. That's the big advantage of linked lists. The last case that we have to sort of concern ourselves with is inserting at the beginning, before the first node, in a previously existing list. That's not terribly difficult to do. It's actually quite simple. We get a new node, we put our element there, we'll go ahead and set its next to null just for consistency. Then we will set its next of this new node. We'll set its next to point to head. That's statement 4 here. That sets this to point to the old head of the list. And then we'll retarget head to this node. What would happen if statements 4 and 5 were accidentally reversed? What would that cause to happen? Well. Okay, so if I do statement 5 before 4, I would set head to P right here. I'd set head equal to P. So head would be pointing to P here, the same node. And then if I set P arrow next equal to head, it would point to itself. So I would basically end up forming a list with one node where that node pointed to itself. And all of the other elements in my list would be what? A memory leak. And it's real easy. And will the compiler tell you that, hey, you're making a mistake here? This isn't right. Will the compiler tell you that? Nah, it could care less. It's not that smart. It'll go ahead and do it. And if you end up having a big memory leak in your program, well, now you've got a very difficult error to find. And a lot of students in this class don't get their last program working because of problems like this. My battery, yeah, there they are. Thought they died. A lot of students don't get the last program working because they end up with memory leaks like this and logic errors in hundreds and hundreds of lines of code that they can't find. And so this is one of the biggest reasons why programs crash nowadays, that systems are unstable. It's because you can have logic errors like this dealing with dynamic memory that are very difficult to trace down and catch. And so you've got to be very careful when you're doing your programming that you don't make these types of mistakes. Basically, you should get into a habit now of, if you've previously been writing statements where you're not sure what they do, you go, well, let me try this. No. Don't write statements that you don't know what they do. Okay? I mean, let's face it. Would you basically walk off a cliff and go, let's see what this does? Okay? Programming is a very logical activity. Like it or lump it, that's the way it is. It's a very logical activity. And it's so logical that you should be able to write code where you know what it's going to do before you execute it. You shouldn't really write code that you aren't sure of what it's going to do. Now, you may make a mistake where you think it's going to do something and it does something slightly different. But at least try to have the confidence before you write it that you know what it's going to do. You'll save yourself a lot of headache in the long run because you'll end up producing code that doesn't have to be debugged. If you can do this perfectly, and very few of us unfortunately are perfect, drive the thistles. Very few of us, unfortunately, are perfect. But if you will try and strive to write code that you know what it's going to do before you ever execute it, you'll save yourself all of that late night debugging that you won't have to do. And I'll tell you that to a certain extent, you're benefiting from the great computer access that we have nowadays. Okay? And I love it. As I told you, there's no such thing as the good old days of computing. But when I first started, I always hate to do this because I'm dating myself. When I first started, I did programming on punch cards. We punched our program out on punch cards. How many executions did I get? About one a day. I got to write my program, and I wrote programs that were still fairly complex, solving simultaneous systems of differential equations using the Newton-Raphson iteration method, all kinds of, you know, with boundary error checking for ill-defined, ill-formed matrices in n-Euclidean dimensional space. I wrote programs that were still fairly complex, even on punch cards. They solved some fairly complex problems. I only got to execute them about once a day because access to computers just wasn't as prevalent as it is nowadays. One thing that taught me, which unfortunately I've probably gotten into a bad habit of not doing as much of, is I made sure when I wrote a statement, I knew what it was going to do, and because I didn't want to make some silly mistake and get my data back, get my results back going, oh, that was dumb. I'll have to wait until tomorrow to fix this one, okay, and run it again. I didn't get, when I did a program for a class, I probably had about 6 runs of the program, and that was all I got. I got 6 runs to get it right, and that was it. And that's not a good way to program. I'm not telling you it's a good way to program, but it did force upon programmers a certain mental discipline, for good or bad. It forced a certain mental discipline upon us. I tried to tell you this to make your life easier, because if you can sort of force yourself into this type of mental discipline, I'm convinced that it will make your life easier, at least in terms of your programming. You don't have to have this type of mental discipline in the rest of your life, okay? That's for the real geeks, okay? Besides myself. I will also tell you, and I always hate to tell you this, that I find it very difficult in programming classes like this to, when people tell me, you need to make your students better problem solvers. You need to make your students learn how to think more logically. This is about the best I can do. I don't know of a good way other than this to do it. I will tell you that I think personally a person learns to think having a certain logical thinking ability when they're much younger. And you can improve it now, but you aren't going to improve it a great amount, unfortunately. I think I was fortunate enough that I had some neighbors who taught me how to play chess when I was younger. And they actually sort of then kept at it until they also got me to go to chess tournaments. And that does impose a very certain logical thinking discipline. I was convinced in high school, I graduated high school with about a C average. Why? Because I spent too much friggin' time playing chess and not doing my homework. I thought my teachers were, okay? I realize now that was stupid. I got to college, I had no AP credit. I had to work my tail off. That was not good. It didn't help me. I was convinced when I was in high school that I wanted to become a chess master. I wanted to make my living playing chess. I wanted to try and become a grandmaster. Now, look it up. Less than 1% of the professional chess players in the world are grandmasters. It's a very elite society. I finally, thank God, during my senior year of high school, I read this book that this one grandmaster had written, where he said, where somebody asked him the question and he faithfully answered it. Somebody asked him, how do you become a grandmaster? And he answered them in the interview, you don't. Grandmasters are born. Masters are made. And he was basically telling everyone, whether you like it or not, we all have limitations. And he basically admitted that he would never become world champion. He wasn't that quality of a caliber of grandmaster. And he had accepted it. But he also basically said, you know, fortunately, I was born with a great gift for doing logical thinking, and it was a gift that was good enough to make me a grandmaster. But he was convinced that if he hadn't been born with this gift, no amount of work would ever do it. Now, I had a friend about the same time that was playing just as much as I was, getting just as poor grades in high school as I was. He decided he wanted to become a master. And he kept at it. And about 2 or 3 years ago, he did it. Okay? He never graduated college, but he's now a master in chess. He doesn't make half the money I do. Who cares? Money is money. He's enjoying his life. He did eventually, after about 20-some years of work, obtain that level. He knows he'll never become a grandmaster. So what I'm telling you is that he really improved his... I couldn't come close to beating him now. I haven't played him in a decade, seriously. He wiped the board with me in no time at all now. I stopped playing after I got to the expert level. I quit playing. Thank God I did. But you can improve your logical thinking ability. If you'll stay at it, you can improve it quite a bit. Don't give up. I'll only improve mine to a certain extent. I've been at it now for 20-some years. But you can improve yours, and you can avoid these stupid memory leaks that is plaguing computer science right now. Plaguing computers. Wondered how I was going to turn all that back around, didn't you? Uh-huh. It wasn't the most smoothest segue, but I got back there, okay? I knew where I was going eventually. But I had to get back there. There are some languages like C# and Java. They try to avoid this. Anybody know how? Huh? No pointers. They have no pointers in the language. Do you know what they have in place of pointers? References. They're hiding the pointers. They're still there. They basically don't require their programmers to keep track of the memory. They'll let the programmers leak it. But they'll go ahead and leak it. They run what's called a garbage collector, which then tries to go through and basically repair the leak, collect the leak. That's what I think of that. I don't believe that a general garbage collection algorithm can take the place of an intelligent, logical thinking programmer managing memory on their own. I think a programmer can do it much better and much smarter. That what you'll study garbage collection algorithms in operating systems and some maybe data structures, and you'll learn why things like that probably. Now here, on the last slide we're going to cover today, or the last couple slides we're going to cover, here on slide 613 is some insert code. Now, I told you that we had a bit of a problem, and that is as we're going down a list trying to find the place that we want to insert at, We're going to keep going down that list as long as the element that we're trying to insert is greater, I don't know why that comma's there, is greater than the current element that we're at. The problem with that is that we'll stop one node too far down. We'll stop at the node that we want to insert before, and we won't be able to change the pointer in the previous node, which we need to change. There's a couple ways of handling this. The first one we'll look at, and in this code, uses the concept of a trailing pointer. It uses two pointers to do the traversal, a previous pointer and a current pointer. And basically, it sets the previous to null and the current to the head, and it checks while the current's not null, while we're not at the end of the list, and the element that we want to insert is greater than the current element. If that's true, then we reset previous to the current one, and we move the current one to the next. That just walks down the list using a trailing pointer and a current pointer. And when we stop with the current pointer pointing to the one that we want to insert before, we've got the previous pointer pointing to the previous node so that we can change the length that's in there. Now, to start off with here, we first get a new node. We include this check here to make sure that that pointer that was allocated from new wasn't null, because if it's null, there's no more memory available. And we can return false, we didn't succeed or something. Otherwise, we'll store the element in this new node, and we'll set it next to null. Then we do our traversal. Now, there's a couple things to note here about this traversal code, besides the fact that that comma shouldn't be there. That irritates me. The greater than here assumes that there's a relational comparison operator for that item type. As long as it's overloaded, it's okay. As long as it's a simple type, it's okay. We just have to realize that that is a dependency in this code. The other one, there's another sort of slight dependency here. See this current pointer not equal to null? This thing, it says this condition in here depends upon Boolean short circuiting to work correctly. Why? Why does this code depend upon Boolean short circuiting to work correctly? Let's let someone who doesn't usually answer. Like someone in the back. You're farthest in the back and you held up your hand, so I'll let you in. That's correct. In other words, I've got this check to see if current pointer is not equal to null first. If that fails, if that ends up being false, because current pointer is null, false and anything is false, so that stops the while loop. And it doesn't check the second part of the condition. Now, if I flip-flop the ordering of these two, then I run into a problem, don't I? What's the problem that I run into? When, if current pointer ever becomes null, and I do the second check first, I'm saying current pointer arrow element, and if current pointer is null, what am I trying to do? Dereference a null pointer. And we've said that they'll blow up on us, right? So do these checks so that you're doing the null check first. That way, with Boolean short circuiting, you won't have to worry about the possibility of dereferencing a null pointer. Then when we come out of this loop, we just check here. If previous pointer is equal to null, what does that tell us about this loop? If previous pointer was equal to null, what does that tell me about that loop? It never what? It never executed. Previous pointer was null here, it was changed inside of here, so if it's null after, it never executed. That, since that loop never executed, that means only one of two conditions has arrived, has arose. Either I'm inserting at the head, it didn't execute because the element that we wanted to insert was less than the first element at the head, so I need to insert before head, or the list was empty. And I can do both of those with the same code. Both of those cases can be handled with the same code by setting new pointer arrow next to head and then setting head to new pointer. Now, the next is null. If I set the head, the next to head, if head is already null, I'm reassigning it to null. That doesn't hurt anything. And then I would be setting head to new pointer, so I now have the head pointing to the new element in a one element list. Otherwise, if head is pointing to some other node, I'm setting this one to point to that previous node that was at the beginning of the list, and then I'm retargeting head to this new pointer, to this new node. And that will work. The other two cases, if previous pointer is not null, then I know that I'm either inserting in the middle of the list or at the tail of the list. And in either case, I can handle that with the same code. I set the next of the previous pointer. The next pointer in the previous node gets set to this new node. And then I set the new node equal to the current pointer. And you can look at both cases where it ends up being at the end of the list or at the middle, and this works regardless. Okay, we'll finish this section up on linked list mechanics on Tuesday. Have a good weekend.